Let me join in welcoming our 15-minute speaker, Jim D. from Morro Bay.
I'm Jim, an alcoholic.
Hey, Jim.
Thanks, Lucas. I'm glad to be here tonight. Glad to be sober. Grateful to be part of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. It always wasn't that way. I know when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous, the first time was in 91 and then again in 96. And that was at the nudge of a judge, as they say. And I didn't want to be there. And I'm not positive what was going on between my ears back then because I can't remember that far back. There's a couple of things I do remember. I remember in 91, I did go to the meetings. And at one of the meetings, I remember hearing a lady share about drinking frozen vodka. And that's what I started doing, was drinking frozen vodka. That's what I got out of the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous back then. In 96, I don't remember any of the meetings. And I probably signed the card by then myself, for the most part. But you know, I just characterize that all off as poor calls and bad officiating on their part. You know, that I was a victim, and you know, who knows? Who knows what kind of bullshit I had going on in my head? My sobriety date's March 13, 2006. So I went another 6 years after the second DUI. Got a little over 15 years now of sobriety. I could tell you this, that before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, what it was like was miserable, extremely miserable. Now, the book talks about terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair, and pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I have a pet peeve that sometimes people leave the pitiful off, and I keep wanting to say, you left that off. It was pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization, all three. I think that the first drink I had probably was as a kid, somewhere along the way, parents or something like that. I do recall mixing a bunch of little alcohol into a jar one time as a kid with the neighbor boys, and us drinking some of that and then probably getting sick or something, you know. But it wasn't something I went out of my way to do, that's for sure. I'm sure I must have had some beer. We touted the Breakfast of Champions Coors when I grew up and in high school, but I was mostly into sports and other things, and we didn't really drink that. And you know, it wasn't something I needed to do. It's a appetite I learned to acquire, learned to appreciate. And I drank whatever I drank for the effect. I'm sure of that. I wanted to get the buzz. You know, I wanted to feel good. And I didn't like the effect if it went too far and the room started spinning when I went to bed or any of that kind of stuff. I really didn't care as much for that. And I certainly didn't like any hangovers as part of that. So but my drinking, I guess you would categorize me as a good example of the progression of the disease of alcoholism. Because it did progress in me. Over time, I drank more. And when I did drink, I drank for the effect, and I drank more than I should have, I'm sure. But there was a turning point in the evolution of my progression, and that was probably about 1985. I was working down in Southern California at the time, and I was going to the office from an appointment with a customer, and I felt like getting a little buzz. So I stopped at a liquor store and I bought one of those little cans of Club, probably vodka tonic or gin and tonic or something like that. And I sipped that on the way back to the office just to get a little buzz going because I felt I deserved it. You know, I guess I, and I share that because up until that point, I didn't drink alone. That, I believe, was a significant step in my case, because after that, I drank alone more often, and the instances between the drinking alone became shorter until it became a daily activity. I was drinking at the end of about a fifth to a quart a day of vodka, usually, although I'd drink anything. I've been doing that for many years. And I was doing that alone. I was hiding it. All of the things that I thought were special that I was doing, I found when I went into the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was just a normal drunk like the rest of them. Nothing I was doing was anything that unique or special. Hiding bottles, pouring vodka into a plastic water bottle and then throwing the vodka bottle away so I could look like I'm just drinking water. Even I used to have a truck with a steel toolbox in the back, and I would hide the empties in there and also full ones, because you need to stock up. But when I bought a pint at a time, usually two or three pints, just in case you need a little more. Because they were more portable, I guess. A lot of rationalizing going on in between his ears back then. And I remember going into the back of that box and taking a bottle of vodka out there and looking at it going, this is hot, because it's been sitting out in the sun. I says, this is going to taste awful, but I know the effect is going to be tremendous. And I started to drink it right out of the hot plastic bottle. Normal people don't do things like that. Normal people would be aghast if they, you know, they're going to get sick or something, I would think. Anyway, that became a not too rare occurrence for me to do stuff like that. Again, drinking for the effect. I could be downtown San Luis Obispo on a Thursday night at Farmer's Market with friends, and hundreds of people around, lots of activities going on. But my head is concerned with the relationship with the alcohol. It's thinking about the plastic water bottle in my back pocket, and does it have enough vodka in it, or do I need to make up some excuse or lie, because I'd become a liar, cheating, and thief, to go get some more vodka at Sandy's to make sure that I had enough. That's where my relationship with the alcohol was taking me. And it was killing me. Physically, I was killing myself. Yeah, maybe slowly, but nevertheless, I was doing it. And my doctor told me that. Still, I would lie to him too. You know, so I don't know why my higher power, I believe in the higher power, which I choose to call God, that I don't understand, but I keep trying to, and I think I'll keep trying to try. But one day he or she gave me enough desperation to ask for help. And that I was later told that's what we call the gift of desperation. At the time, I didn't think of it as a gift. I was very miserable and I was hurting bad. But nevertheless, that's what it took to get me to ask for help. I didn't go to Alcoholics Anonymous to get the help. I went to a rehab in San Luis Obispo, an outpatient clinic. What I found unique there, though, that when I called them up, and I had their number because I told my wife that I was looking into things like that a while before, just to get the heat off, and so I knew there was one, and I found her number fairly easy. What I found unique about that is that they said, "Come down and we'll have a chat." Which they what they wanted to do was interview me and see know, how bad was I? Did I need to go to the inpatient or could I go to the outpatient? That kind of stuff. Maybe I needed detox, you know. And I went down, talked to him, and I found it interesting that I didn't lie to him. I actually told him the truth, at least the best that I could at the time. The kinds of things they were asking me, I would have lied to whoever else it was that asked me that kind of stuff up until that day to protect the relationship with the alcohol, because that's the only relationship at the end. You know, the basic needs and security as a human being were distorted to the needs and security of safety of that relationship I had with the alcohol. Nevertheless, I enrolled in that, and what, in hindsight, I can say they taught me was that they were going to give me an excellent education on the disease of alcoholism. But here's the big book in the 12 and 12, and you need to go to AA, you need to get a sponsor, and you need to take the steps, and you need to go to at least 4 meetings a week and report to us about all that, because that's, after all, the solution to your problem. I can tell you that in hindsight, that's not what I saw or heard at the time. But what I heard at the time was they had a disciplinary program and it had structure to it. And that was, I could see how valuable that would be to for me to follow some kind of structure and take their, if I really wanted to help, to take their suggestions and follow through on them, which I did. I didn't go to meetings in San Luis Obispo. I went to meetings in Rio Grande, even though I lived in San Luis. So I was still hedging my bets there a little. But it didn't matter. I did go to the meetings. And in between judging you guys, I listened to what you said. And what I heard there were things that I could identify with, things that I could relate to. I learned that I wasn't unique. I wasn't that different. I was just a regular, normal, run-of-the-mill drunk. And that there was a solution for the problem I had. The problem I had was alcoholism. And I had lots of excuses and stories that I could tell, but the bottom line was I had alcoholism and I needed the help of another alcoholic and 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous to deal with that problem. So I kept going to meetings. I got roped into commitments. We have a way of doing that sometimes to ourselves. I remember two older guys that were outside. I was talking to them outside the Nelson Street Milano Club before it moved. And they were saying, Jim, you need the secretary meeting. Which one do you want, Saturday or Sunday night? So, you know, I wasn't given a, do you want one? It was, which one do you want? So I picked Sunday night. Turns out that was a step meeting, which was real. I mean, that wasn't supposed to happen that way. And I ended up for years going to a 12 and 12 step meeting and traditions, which was invaluable to me. And the people there that helped me along the way, it's just, I'll forever be grateful for that and for all the people here as well. I know the disease of alcoholism is a progressive disease. And I know that it doesn't stop progressing even though I stop drinking. I know that because I've seen other alcoholics who have gone back out and relapsed and drank. And I've seen some of them die and fairly quickly. And then I've seen a few of them come back and I've heard their stories and they told me what happened. And that when they started drinking again, it very quickly turned it very ugly on them. They didn't actually go back to drinking the way they were when they left. They actually ended up drinking very quickly to where they would have been had they stayed drinking the whole time. And that volume of alcohol kills people sometimes. So it's a deadly disease. I know that. I know it has a self-destructive component to it. It wants to get me. There's a couple of good examples of that that I talk about occasionally, and I'll share one of those with you tonight. When I was about 3 years sober, I used to go down to Santa Maria and visit my dad on Sundays before he passed away. He was in a care facility, and I'd take him over to his house, which was a few blocks away from there, and let him visit his chair and his mail and stuff like that. And we'd go for drives and things like that. And while he was there at his house, I would go looking around. And when I was in the kitchen and was looking in the cupboards, and I opened one of the cupboard doors, and in there was a bottle of a fifth of Smirnoff vodka, which was my drug of choice. And it wasn't the liquor cabinet where he had normally kept his bottle. It was a different one. So I have no idea how it got there, but there it was. And every week I would go back, take my dad there so he could sit in his chair. And then I'd go into that kitchen sometime during the visit, and I'd open that cupboard door, and I'd look in there to visit with the bottle of alcohol that's sitting in there. I'd open up that door and I'd look at it, just make sure it was still there, see how it's doing. I even reached in one time, took it out, and tested the seal on to make sure it had. I was beginning to develop the relationship with that bottle again. And I know the power of that, because it was drawing me in. It was drawing me in. And if I didn't have a sponsor, and if I didn't have other alcoholics that I talked to about that, who said, "Are you out of your goddamn mind, man? What do you know what you're doing? Get rid of that thing." You know, if I didn't have that, if I didn't have some closeness, at least, that I'd gotten as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous to my higher power, I would not have had a defense against drinking that bottle. And I would have relapsed for sure. So that's a good reminder for me. And I hope that'll maybe help you think of some for yourselves, because they are there. They happen every now and then, and it just reminds me that the disease is always going to be there. But if I'm not working on recovery, I'm working on a relapse. It may not be a relapse of drinking right away. I think it'll probably be, for me, a relapse in character defects, which I have occasionally, and they'll get worse until I go back to being and acting and behaving like the man I used to be, and the guy I used to be will drink again. So I know that if I continue to do this deal, and by that I mean continue to participate in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, to continue to try to stay close to my higher power and to be of service, try to help others. If I keep doing that, then I'll have that protection against that first drink. So I think I'll just keep doing that, and on occasion maybe be asked to speak at an occasion like this, which I'm very honored to do. Thank you very much, Lucas. That's all I got.
All right. Thank you, Jim. Let's give Jim another round of applause. Thank you so much.